Hey, good morning, everyone. Bright and early today. Let's see. I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll. Chair is present.
Good morning. Schultz, present. Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, present.
Thank you. Representative Burkle.
Burkle, present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Keel. I know that Representative Keel is here. I'll move on. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Happy Friday.
Thank you, sir. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present. Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members. We have a quorum, Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and thank you, members. Okay, members, we have a full day today. And as soon as we can finish, you can leave and take a break or go to your next committee since it is deadline week. So looking forward to the next 2 weeks. So members, the first order of business is to approve the minutes from March 24th. Representative Albright, do you want to make a motion to do so?
Madam Chair, I've had a first cup of coffee and I've read the minutes. They seem fine to me, but I will move them. So noted. Given the fact that I may not be able to see all the words.
Okay, Representative Albright moves the minutes from March 24th. Members, this is a voice vote. Please unmute. Or any corrections, sorry, any corrections to the minutes? Not seeing any. All those in favor of adopting the minutes? Oops, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, the first bill on our agenda is House File 3529, and I see Representative Albright. Welcome, or I'm sorry, I see Representative Vogelmaat. Welcome back to the committee. I don't see any amendments.
Madam Chair, he's just a younger me with better hair. So.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I must admit that I am jealous of Representative Albright's beard, so I take it as a full compliment. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. I'm not seeing any amendments, so I'm going to, my motion will be to lay over House File 3529 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Tell us about your bill, Representative Vogelmaat.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright and committee members. I am honored to be in your committee this morning and present House File 3529. I'm presenting this bill because law enforcement agencies, both in my community in St. Cloud, and all across Minnesota are being challenged by a growing number of calls for service involving people with mental health needs. And as law enforcement agencies contemplate how to best serve these residents, they're exploring additional service models. Some law enforcement agencies are considering embedding social service professionals from other governmental jurisdictions or in partnership with agencies when officers respond to calls. Other law enforcement agencies are considering not having officers respond to these calls, but only sending a social services professional to respond. And while these social services professionals are able to gather helpful information for their work during these response calls, current law limits them from sharing any data that would be helpful for law enforcement as they respond to other calls involving these same people. So given the desire for more nuanced ways to address people with mental health needs, the current law shouldn't be an obstacle to how law enforcement agencies can work best with other entities who are also providing care for people with mental health needs. So, and able to respond to this challenge, the current law is putting on our law enforcement and on those who are concerned about the health and safety of our Minnesotans who are experiencing mental health crises. We've been working with the League of Minnesota Cities to gather stakeholders to discuss this issue. And the real goal here, Madam Chair and members, is to balance the importance of privacy given the sensitive nature of mental health data. The stakeholders included law enforcement agencies, county human services, county community corrections, county attorneys, private healthcare providers, and NAMI, and I'm grateful to have Sue Aber holding on here and want to make clear, members, that NAMI is okay with this bill. And this bill I'm presenting this morning, Madam Chair, is a reflection of the work that's been done in conjunction with all those stakeholders. So here's the crux of the bill. Again, the problem is that the current law has in place a threshold for sharing the data as an emergency interaction, and that's been interpreted as very high. And there, because of that, there hasn't been the ability to share as much data as could be helpful on mental health calls. So in this bill I'm bringing forward, instead of using emergency interaction as a threshold, sections 1 and 2 of this bill change the threshold to mental health crisis. Next, these two sections also make clear that strategies to address the mental health crisis may be shared with law enforcement. And then the third section of this bill, Madam Chair, addresses the adult protection team statute. Our current law allows multidisciplinary teams to meet for case management purposes. These teams generally include county representatives, mental health providers, but there are folks who are not included who could provide additional insights. And that's why we're bringing these changes forward. This section includes community corrections agencies and local law enforcement, because most of our mental health calls are being responded to by police officers. So allowing them to participate in this proactive manner will allow individuals directed to treatment instead of jail and allow the data necessary to keep situations to be safe and with the goal of not escalating, protecting the safety of these Minnesotans who are having mental health crises, as well as the safety of our law enforcement. So that's the bill, Madam Chair. That's what the bill does. That's who I've been working with on this. That's why I'm bringing it forward. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I have some testifiers who can provide further insight to this bill.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for that presentation. I'm going to go to our first testifier, Nikki Niles. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Nikki Niles, Director of Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County Community Corrections. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of AMC and MICA in support of House File 3529. In Olmsted County, we have implemented a multidisciplinary team consisting of social workers within County Corrections Department who work in partnership with the Rochester Police Department and Olmsted County Sheriff's Office. The team works together to respond to calls for emergency and non-emergency services to address public health concerns, such as mental health, chemical health, substance abuse, and well-being. This program is working well, and it's working well to not introduce persons into our criminal justice system and or getting persons out of the criminal justice system exclusively based on public health concerns. But we're finding that some data sharing laws are too limiting to offer the needed assistance to the people that we serve. Members of this social worker team, or our community outreach team as we've named it, need the ability to talk to one another and offer community partners, both internal and external to the organizations, to effectively do the work. If I may, I'd like to share a specific incident that happened here in Olmsted County, where the workers needed the need to communicate with other partners, such as law enforcement, Mayo Hospital, Olmsted Medical Center, other external community health partners, and other social workers within the county. For example, there was a call that was just dispatched out as a check person's call. Once the social workers arrived on scene, Rochester Police Department also arrived. Upon trying to make contact with this person that they were checking on, they realized the person did not speak English. Situation continued to escalate, at which one point the person produced a knife. RPD immediately took hold of scene, social workers backed off, and now they were secondary to this call. Because of our existing MDT, the specialist team that the client learned that the client was working with an external partner and under the care of a psychiatrist at Mayo Clinic. The external social worker arrived on scene after being contacted by our secondary social workers that were on scene and were able to translate for the person that was now in crisis, and the team was in contact with the physician. Being able to relay this information in real time was critical to the decision making for our law enforcement partners on this scenario, and it reflected in the ultimate determination of what happened to the client. After the client calmed down and compliance was gained, the client was transported to the hospital without further incident and received the care that they needed. In this situation, due to the way things were escalating, harm wasn't caused to the client, to our law enforcement partners, or to the social workers that were on scene. Being able to access the minimum amount of information during this service call was absolutely essential. We are ensuring that the minimum information necessary is gathered with this best practice. That's the utmost important. Data is protected with the existing laws and statutes that are in place, and we take extra measures to protect that information. We also recognize that this work in other jurisdictions sometimes solely falls on law enforcement. The language of this bill makes situations like the one that I described efficient. We thank Representative Wolgamott for authoring this legislation, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Niles, for joining us so early this morning. The next testifier I have is Terrell Clark. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Clark, are you with us? No, I'm not seeing Commissioner Clark. We'll go to the next testifier. Let's see, we have Jody Gertkin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm Jody Gertkin. I'm with CentraCare. I wasn't planning to testify this morning to be here for questions, but I will say that as the primary healthcare system in the greater St. Cloud area, we fully support this House File 3529. Members of our legal team and our Population Health Division have been intimately involved in our community action team, which is comprised of those community partners Representative Wolgamott just mentioned. We take our privacy of our patients very seriously, but we are also acutely aware that the mental health crisis is certainly gotten exponentially worse since the pandemic. And we want to do everything that we can to ensure that our patients are being well taken care of outside of our clinic and hospital settings. And we want to be a partner engaged in that opportunity. So I will stand for any questions, but just know that you have our full support for this bill, and we look forward to seeing it move forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gertkin, for being with us. Representative Wolgamott, I know we have others for questions. I believe we have Matthew Massman from the Minnesota Intercounty Association and Irene Cow from the Intergovernmental Relations Council and the League of Minnesota Cities. And if Commissioner Clark shows up, we will have her testify. Is that correct, Representative Wolgamott?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, we'll go to questions. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Representative Wolgamott. A couple questions for you on the basis, and you can probably defer to your testifiers. The first question, anytime that we're talking about medical records, anytime we're talking about the privacy and or the rights of an individual, obviously it perks up our ears. The first question is, at inception, when you roll up on scene, the question is, how, who, and when does someone decide that you need access to this data based upon the scene? What is the catalyst for your officer to determine that they need more information? How is that determined?
Representative Wolgamott, would you like to go to a testifier?
Would like to answer Representative Albright's question, and then I can hand it over to my testifier, Sachet, for the light, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead, Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Albright. And you're right, anytime that we are talking about sharing Minnesotans' data, we do need to have our ears perk up, and we do need to make sure that there is a good threshold. So in this bill, Sections 1 and 2, we're changing the threshold for the catalyst for what triggers this is getting changed from emergency interaction to mental health crisis. And we're doing that, Madam Chair and Representative Albright, because mental health crisis is already statutorily defined in Minnesota statute. It's 256B.0624 subdivision 2. and that's defined as a behavioral, emotional, or psychiatric situation that, without the provision of crisis response services, would likely result in significantly reducing the recipient's levels of functioning and primary activities of daily living in an emergency situation under Section 62Q.55, or in the placement of the recipient in a more restrictive setting, including but not limited to inpatient hospitalization. So that's part of what this bill is trying to do, is have a already statutorily defined catalyst or trigger point, however you like to describe it. That's part of why we're bringing this bill forward, is to have a more clear scope of what would trigger this data sharing. So that's what we're trying to do with this bill, Madam Chair and Representative Albright, but would also welcome input from my testifiers to shed more light to answer Representative Albright's question.
Okay, I see that we have Ms. Abderholden popped up and we have Commissioner Clark here. So Ms. Abderholden, we want to respond to that, but first please state your name and your affiliation and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I think you have to think about what's happening at the moment. So maybe there's a call into 911 saying someone's having a mental health crisis. The officers are going out. You are not exchanging medical records at this point, right? There's not time. There's also, police departments often don't have electronic medical records. What you really want is any information that might help address the crisis. So what we see happening and what happened under the under the current statute is that, maybe you're able to contact the county case manager for the individual, find out if they have a case manager, and you find out, oh, they're actually going to the Central Minnesota, mental health center. And they call there and they say, oh, yes, this person actually has been hearing voices lately. And here's some things that you might do to actually calm the situation down. So we see it as really, and we even in our discussions, we said, you don't even need the diagnosis in many ways. You just need to know what the symptoms are that you might want to address. This won't happen all the time. A call in the middle of the night, you're not going to be able to get a county case manager or get in contact with the therapist or the psychiatrist. But we really see this as limiting the information to what you need in order to address the crisis. So we don't actually, NAMI doesn't see that they're going to be exchanging medical records, just basic information.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Representative Albright, we'll go to your next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple of follow-on based upon the answers. Very intriguing. So my daughter is a paramedic. And typically when they get a call to go out on this type of a call, they're rolling and they're receiving information in real time based upon the caller that's coming into 911 and it's being dispatched to first responders, whether that be the county sheriff or the paramedics, ambulance, that type, as they're rolling. Would those medical records or that inference, could it be shared at that time or in terms of, you're saying that we're not sharing medical data, but to your point about, I've heard stories and been told stories recounted by my daughter about the information that has been provided to them by the 911 call, and they roll up on scene, and it's very, very different from what the information, in some cases it was purported to be a psychiatric break. And what actually happened was the person had lost their inhaler and they were having an asthmatic attack, but they were, really, really in dire straits. So my concern is in a medical situation, how does the first responder discern in real time when you have literally seconds or not even minutes to determine the welfare of that individual? How would this bill enable first responders to adequately and properly respond to that type of event? And please understand, this is not a detraction or a denigration of the issue, but we want to put the client and the patient at the very center of the care. So how do we appropriately discern what is appropriate care?
Let's see, Ms. Abderholden or Representative Vogelmaat?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that Nikki Niles has has a hand up. So.
Oh, thank you for that. Didn't see that. Ms. Niles.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright, for that question. I think I would support what Ms. Aberholden testified to, and the fact that when those 911 calls come in, we have to keep in mind that those calls are coming in from maybe persons in the community that don't have the training, the knowledge, the experience to really fully describe what it is that they're witnessing. And so in the situation that you described, sir, what was really just an asthmatic attack to the layman, right, to the caller that called in, that was described as a psychiatric episode. When the professionals arrive on scene, be that law enforcement, paramedics, social worker, or a combination of both, those are trained professionals in those respective areas. They know the signs and the signals and the things to look for. So with hopes that in that situation, they would be able to ascertain it was really a medical incident and not a psychiatric incident, and they would rely on the training and expertise of what they are trained to do. In the situation, much like I described, that's exactly kind of what happened. It was just, hey, something isn't right with this particular person. We need to check on them. And as events escalated and as information was being relayed and as the social worker arrived on scene that could translate to Ms. Aberholden's point, gradually they were able to resolve the situation in a safe manner for that client. Thank you,
Ms. Niles. I see Commissioner Clark. Please introduce yourself, and then if you want to give your testimony and answer the question, that would be great.
Oh, thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'm Terrell Clark, Stearns County Commissioner, and I'm here today on behalf of not only our county, but AMC and MICA as well. And thank you for letting me pop back in. So I think, you know, as you've already heard, I mean, it's really important that we are careful with what individuals' information it is, how it's shared and what is shared, and how we can do better for the person. And, you know, this particular bill is not likely to solve every situation, but it can make a big difference stepping forward. So to perhaps another example from off of Representative Albright's question is the situation where law enforcement might get like a non-emergency welfare check call. They arrive on the scene. It appears the person has a mental illness crisis. If they could call the county and find out if the person's assigned to a social worker, they could provide information to prevent the person from getting transported to detox, ER, jail, and instead perhaps could get transported to a supportive family member. So the in-depth medical information isn't necessary, but that connection to be able to make a difference for the person in the moment is. So for example, you know, verifying the agency and the entity has contact with the information, who the social worker has been working with, or perhaps the person in corrections, the mental health person, and allow the, as you heard with a couple of the other examples, to share some strategies to de-escalate the situation or get that person to the best place for them. So it would really decrease the problems that we're seeing and increase the likelihood of positive outcome between the person that's struggling with these issues. And just wanted to give that additional example, because those are the kinds of things that we do see. So this is not a broad opening of scope. It is trying to be very narrowly tailored. And then people will be able to continue working with the individual in the normal ways.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just final question, and for the testifiers as well as Representative Wolgamott. You know, anytime, getting back to my opening statement, anytime we're accessing this data, it is retained in some form, whether it even be on the squad's laptop or in 911 as it's coming through. And in an age where information just continues to mount and grow and has to be stored someplace or purged, and the verification of that purging of the data, but also from a beneficial, oddly enough, perspective in terms of the sharing of this information for occurrences with a patient as they move forward in terms of others that might benefit from the information that was gathered on scene to articulate a better response for, you know, treatment, that type of thing. what protocols are in place, one for the sharing of that data, the purging of that data, or the security of that data in terms of a cybersecurity threat, whether it be, you know, oddly enough, you know, people share data or you grab data for, you know, sadly, very nefarious reasons. And so I'm sure this was carried in judiciary, but in a healthcare perspective, from a patient's perspective, everyone has rights and that they need to protect it. So Representative Wolgema, to your question, how do we, what protocols do we follow? Is it a committee? Is it a protocol that we follow that disseminates the protection of those rights with that individual's data?
Representative Wolgema.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. A lot of it just depends on the situation and the nature of the investigation, the depth of the investigation, the length of the investigation. I want to be clear that current law already limits that disclosure is limited to the minimum necessary for law enforcement to respond to the mental health crisis. And, you know, what is shared is the name of the person working with the individual, the strategies to address the mental health crisis. I know that Ms. Irene Gao from the League of Minnesota Cities is here and can provide further insight on this, but again, current law already limits the disclosures limited to the minimum necessary for law enforcement to respond to the mental health crisis. But with your permission, Madam Chair, I know that Ms. Gao from the League of Minnesota Cities can provide further insight to answer Representative Albright's question.
Thank you. Ms. Cao, please introduce yourself and give your affiliation and then proceed with your response, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Irene Gao and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Representative Albright, thank you for that question. I know you had framed it, you're right, this was in judiciary, but you had framed it also in terms of the provider's perspective. I think part of the question that you are asking is what happens once that data is shared, either from a provider or from a county in terms of human services. And then that data, it does reside with law enforcement. Both the current law and what the bill would maintain is that classification of the data continues to be private and can only be used for the purposes in which you have the call. So in this instance, it would be that it's a mental health call and it can't be used for any other purposes. The concerns that you have generally raised are concerns that government entities are concerned about, particularly when you were talking about cybersecurity and access to it. It's important that the law limits it in this way and that our association, along with other local government associations, would support that. The privacy is an important aspect when we're talking about this. While we want to ensure that our law enforcement agencies are able to properly respond to these calls, there is no interest in using this data in any other way. It is only to respond to the mental health call.
Thank you, Ms. Gao. Let's see. I'm going to go to Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, everyone. And Representative Albright, I thank you for your good questions. And I share a lot of those and a lot of the same concerns. And I think I've seen over the years, there's a lot of bipartisan concern over these very issues. So we want to make sure we absolutely get this right, recognizing it's a real problem. And that we're all looking for solutions to these concerns, but we do want to get this right. So I have a couple questions. One kind of following on Representative Albright's question about what happens to the data. What I've been hearing is sort of all assuming that the person does not end up arrested. And one of the concerns that I have is that now that we've shared the data with law enforcement, if they end up getting arrested anyway, which I know is not the goal, people are thinking here that this might avert that. But assuming that it doesn't avert it, are we then putting people's private information into police reports where it's basically there forever? And you know, I heard the explanation about this being protected data, but police report data generally has different protections, or fewer, I think. And so that's one concern that I have. What happens then? And let me just state the second question too, and which is a different one. Looking at the language of the bill, and I hope I have the right version because I know there's been a change, but we have on line 3.21, well, what's being added to the bill, The disclosure may include, but is not limited to, the name and phone number of the psychiatrist, et cetera, if known, and strategies to address the mental health crisis. I personally feel comfortable with most of that. What I'm not comfortable with there or have questions about is not limited to. So, you know, the disclosure may include, but is not limited to, who the person's been working with and strategies to address the health crisis. I don't understand what else is in that is not limited to. It seems to be a very, very broad thing. So those are my two concerns, if someone could address them. So first one being what happens to the data if they're addressed, if they're arrested.
Representative Ogilmott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for your questions. And I know you and I have been chatting about this bill a lot outside of the committee process, and that is a large part of why we're laying the bill over today, is so that we can continue to work together to address your concerns and hopefully earn your support for this important legislation. Madam Chair, I would like to welcome my testifiers and the stakeholders who I've worked with on this legislation to best address Chair Liebling's questions. I know that Ms. Gao can build off of her answer to Representative Albright's question in this, and then we can get to I guess for Representative Liebling's first question. Let's take that one, let's do one question at a time here. Madam Chair, with your permission, I think it would be beneficial for you and the committee members to hear from Ms. Irene Gao.
Thank you. Ms. Gao.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, thank you for the question. So I actually am going to take the second question first, Representative Wogelmott. Hopefully that's okay, because I'm worried that I'm going to forget the answer. And so if you notice, Chair Liebling, what's happening is that we had paralleled the language that was actually in 13.46 in the health in the welfare data section. But admittedly, I think that we could probably strike the language that you have highlighted, because at that point in time, when it was just that language, we hadn't included strategies to address the mental health crisis. So thank you for bringing that up. That's the key part of that, as Ms. Aberholden had discussed, is it's not that we're looking to share health records. We're looking just for the basic information to address the mental health call. So that is something we for sure can address. Now that I remember that, the second piece around it is very much a data practices question. I hope that I want to confirm that this is the case, but often when there's a conflict about what is public, because you're right, there is under law enforcement data, there is certain data that is considered public. There then is other classification where it's private. Here it is important to have that classification of it being private. I do believe that that is what would trump in this situation. But I do want to confirm with House Research and some other folks that that is the case, because there is no situation in which we want to be sharing data, this type of data, publicly if it's not needed to do so.
Chair Liebling?
Madam Chair. Oh, sorry to interrupt, Chair Liebling, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to bring your attention that Ms. Aberholden had her hand up, I think.
Ms. Aberholden.
Representative Liebling's questions.
Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. The other thing to remember is that when an officer goes out on a call, it's likely already categorized as a disturbed person. And so they kind of add those tags when they go to respond to, especially mental health crisis calls. So that person has already been tagged in the system as a disturbed person. And so I think knowing that someone might have a mental health issue sounds a lot better than disturbed person. But so just wanted to make sure you knew that information as well.
And Madam Chair, if I could just
respond. Chair Liebling.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I don't know. Ms. Aberholden, when cops go out to a call, there's always a disturbed person. That's probably why they're going to the call. I mean, I don't think that necessarily says that someone has a mental health condition. I may be wrong, but I don't think that means we're wide open on that.
Okay. Any other questions, Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for the bill. And I just wanted to remind folks that, yes, this did go through judiciary, but Chapter 13 has other protections for storing data when it's destroyed, what the responsible authority has to do. It's a misdemeanor for someone to share data that's private. There are other requirements that responsible authorities have to follow if there's been a breach of data. And those are all other provisions in Chapter 13 that would still apply here. So just thought I would remind members, especially those of you who aren't on judiciary, that we have a lot of protections for data within Chapter 13. That's all I have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I also serve on judiciary. And, you know, we heard a lot of these questions already, and the bill was laid over there, and now it doesn't look like there's been progress on some of those issues, and it's getting laid over again. So I'm just wondering, will we hear it again? How will we know what the outcome of this all is going to be?
That's a great question, Representative Robbins. So, yes, I hope they work together until our omnibus, and if they can resolve many of these issues, it may appear in the omnibus bill. So this will be laid over so they have time to work on it. Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your interest in your question, this Representative Robbins. I just want to be clear that the bill was not laid over in judiciary. It actually passed out of the Judiciary Committee by vote of 12-2 and was sent to this committee. So it was not laid over. It passed on a vote of 12-2, Madam Chair, and Representative Robbins.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I just think it's too early for us. We'll get better here. Representative Robbins.
Yes, and you're right. And I voted for it there, honestly, in support of knowing we'd have another kick at the can here. But so that is my intention, to make sure that whether it comes back to judiciary to deal with these data issues or it comes back in this committee, this is really paramount, and I do support what you're trying to do. I really do. I think it's important. I've done ride-alongs with my officers on mental health calls, and it's amazing what they have to deal with. And having this information would be helpful, but, you know, I think we'd also discuss consent and audit trails in the Judiciary Committee. So I just, you know, hope you will really take seriously considering to work on that, because I know a lot of us who supported this still have real reservations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I thought it was important to bring it in front of this committee, knowing how important this issue is, and to meet the deadline in case they do make some progress on resolutions. But I did think it was important to bring it here today. So I'm not seeing any other questions. Representative Wolgamott, final closing comments.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I'll be brief because I know you've got a full agenda. I just would like to say to Representative Robbins and every member of this committee that I want to work, whatever it takes to work with you to get your support for this legislation. This has been a problem in my community for years, and we have to work together and make progress on this so that we can, it's about safety. It's about the safety for those who are experiencing mental health crisis. It's about safety for our law enforcement. We want to, of course, balance those concerns with the data privacy, and welcome working with you and everyone on this committee to find a solution that we can move forward. So thank you for that, Representative Robbins. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, for your time this morning. And thank you to every member of this committee for your consideration of this important legislation.
I want to thank Representative Wolgamott, and I want to thank all of our testifiers for joining us this morning. And you have your marching orders. Go work on it. So with that, House File 3529 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3840. Welcome back, Representative Edelson. I'm not seeing any amendments, so I'll make the motion to lay over House File 3840 for possible inclusion in Human Services Omnibus Bill. Please tell us about your bill, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to keep my comments pretty short because my throat hurts and I'm very sick, which is like the plus about virtual meetings here right now. So, Madam Chair, members, we have staffing shortages in our care industry across the state. This bill provides rate increases for respiratory therapists, home health services, and home care nursing. With this, these services can range from care when you're coming home from the hospital to nursing doing ongoing services for a long period of time. This bill proposes adjusting the medical assistant MA reimbursement rate to be more in line with the Medicare reimbursement rate. This will help us address that staffing crisis in a way. I'm not going to fix it entirely, but it's definitely a good step forward. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Home Association, Home Care Association. And Madam Chair, I'm going to go to my testifiers.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ellison. I hope you feel better soon. The first testifier is Kathy Meserly. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Edelson, Chair Schultz, and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Meserly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association. Our members provide hands-on care to more than 30,000 older Minnesotans and individuals with disabilities in their own homes. At MHCA, we're acutely aware of the rapidly growing number of Minnesotans who, without access to home care services, would have to turn to more intensive, expensive, and currently overstressed facility-based care, such as hospitals and long-term care settings. We know it's not the preferred option for most Minnesotans, and our state budget cannot afford to provide that more intensive level of care to all who need it. Thank you for the investments made in home care last session. They were very appreciated. However, there still remains very real needs for addressing low reimbursement rate for home care services and the impact that has on providing the needed care. The bill before you today proposes to adjust the medical assistance per visit reimbursement rates for home care services to be somewhat closer to the Medicare rates for these same services. The services include nursing, home health aides, and rehab therapies. If we as a state value supporting older Minnesotans and those with disabilities and complex health needs to remain living in their own homes and avoiding that more expensive care, we must make these services more accessible. The current low rates make it extremely challenging to pay a sufficient wage, which means that those in need of services aren't able to access them or are not able to get all of the needed hours of care filled. Adjusting these rates will help increase access to the needed services by providing a more sustainable reimbursement rate, allowing more Minnesotans to live as independently as possible. I will now turn it over to Camille Zender to speak very briefly about her organization's experience providing home care services.
Thank you, Ms. Meserly. And we are over time, so we need to talk quickly and move through these bills. The next testifier is Camille Zender. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Camille Zender, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer with Pediatric Home Service. We provide hospital-level care to medically fragile children, including home care nursing and high-tech medical equipment services. Home care services are critical for this population of children and adults with disabilities. I'm speaking today as a pediatric provider, but the challenges are felt equally across all agencies and patients, regardless of age. I will be brief to allow sufficient time for our next testifier to share their story. So I'm going to go to the numbers because I think the numbers are really quite compelling. There was a study published in Minnesota in 2016. That study showed that children remained in the hospital unnecessarily and medically stable for discharge for over 50 days based on a lack of access to nursing services. That data was refreshed for the years 2020 and 2021 and found that discharge was delayed for an additional 40 days for the same reason. Not enough nurses. A conservative cost estimate for the unnecessary hospitalizations is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for each delayed discharge, more than enough to pay for an overdue and well-deserved increase for the level of skill provided by home care services. Under the current rate structure, agencies cannot compete with hospital-based wages, and I'm not referring to the astronomical wage competition we're seeing today. I mean pre-pandemic base wages. Our nurses earn what they can make in a hospital, and they deserve the same pay for the same work that they do in our homes. As evidence of the workforce crisis, PHS has experienced a 30% reduction in our home care nursing staff year over year. This means reduced coverage for our kids and their families. Again, to translate that into numbers, our agency historically has been able to assure coverage for over 90% of scheduled hours for each child. That average now hovers just over 70%. Our children and our families deserve better. We recognize that a rate increase alone cannot solve this workforce crisis, but it's a foundational fault that must be solved before additional approaches can have any impact. I thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I will now turn it over to Mr. Bennett to describe the role of home care services in their life.
Thank you, Ms. Zender. The next testifier we have is Jason Bennett. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jason Bennett. I'm not appearing today with any professional affiliation, but as the father of a severely disabled child. I live in North Mankato with my fiance and our blended family of four children ranging in age from 11 to 21. I work as a detective for a police department, and my fiance works in state government. I have a bachelor's degree in law enforcement from Minnesota State University, Mankato, and a master of public administration degree with an emphasis on public policy and administration. I also serve on the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. I appear before you today to briefly discuss the critical importance of House File 3840 to our family. My daughter Ashlyn is 17 years old and a sophomore at Mankato East High School. In 2008, she was diagnosed with Rett syndrome. Rett syndrome is caused by a genetic mutation in the X chromosome, meaning that she cannot walk or talk, effectively communicate with others, or interact with her environment. She has no purposeful use of her arms or legs. She requires frequent respiratory treatment, suctioning, and oxygen at baseline. She's on nearly two dozen medications. She's completely dependent on others for everything. To list all of her cares would take longer than the time I have available. In short, she requires a hospital level of care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to remain at home. Ashlyn receives in-home care nursing from Pediatric Home Service, and they're an amazing company. I've heard nothing but positives from the nurses that work there. However, I know that many home care companies like PHS cannot pay the nurses that provide care for Ashlyn wages that are competitive. Over the years, we've lost many nurses to better paying hospital jobs, and very few stay to work in home care longer than a couple of years. Ashlyn must have quality home care nursing 24 hours a day, and right now she doesn't. We need at least four full-time nurses to provide 24-hour care, and right now we have one. That nurse accompanies Ashlyn to school, and right now that nurse is currently unable to work, and there are no backup nurses. So right now, Ashlyn can't even go to school. And when there is no nurse, like now, my fiance or I must provide the care for Ashlyn no matter the time of day or night. The current situation for our family is untenable. If we don't have nursing, one or both of us will have to leave our jobs just to provide the basic medical care that Ashlyn needs to keep her alive. We will not be able to be Ashlyn's parents. We will be her nurses. We will no longer be able to provide insurance coverage for our family. We have three other children who we will not be able to devote the necessary time and attention to. We will have no time to be a family. There will be no quality of life to speak of for Ashlyn or our entire family. All of our time, energy, and resources will be dedicated to attempting to provide a level of medical care that Ashlyn needs, care that we are not qualified to provide, and which will likely lead to very poor health outcomes for Ashlyn. I'm not so naive to think that this bill will solve all the problems of the home care nursing shortage. It won't, but it's a step in the right direction. It will help Ashlyn and children like her to be healthy and to remain at home, to receive the quality medical care that they need, and allow families like ours to continue to work in and contribute to our communities. It will let us be parents to our medically fragile children. I'm happy to help in any way possible, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett, for joining us this morning and for sharing that testimony. So with that, members, we'll open it up for questions. And we have Kevin Goodnow available and Brianna Lindell with us. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett, for coming and speaking to the impact that this has on your family. I have a curiosity question. You mentioned that the nurse that you currently have been using is unable to provide care. And I'm curious if we know why that individual is no longer able to provide care.
Mr. Bennett?
Yes, thank you. I believe it was an injury.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Thank you for that. I was just curious. I know we've been hearing across the spectrum a lot of folks who have been struggling with returning to work for other reasons like childcare or whatnot. I was curious if that might have been a factor in your situation as well. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Edelson, thank you for bringing this forward. And Mr. Bennett, thank you for testimony. My only question, and this may be answered by one of the testifiers, but I see that there is a difference between the proposed rate increase for respiratory therapy and health services, as well as a slight increase for home health aides. And I'm just curious why the disparity between those two.
Madam Chair.
Representative Edelson.
I think maybe Ms. Meserly would be the best to answer that
question. Ms. Meserly.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Albright. Yes, thank you for noting that. That is, the difference is because those rates are already closer to the Medicare rates. So we are not asking to bring it up to the Medicare rate. We wanted to get them all consistently at the same percentage of Medicare. Does that answer your question?
Representative Albright.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on, for Ms. Meserly or Representative Edelson, it says the rates would be effective January 1st, 2023 upon federal approval. How difficult has that been in the past, and do we anticipate that this would be a streamlined process?
Ms. Meserly?
I'm going to suggest that Kevin Goodnow may be able to answer that question, but I don't believe it will be a difficult process.
Do we want DHS to answer that question?
Yes.
I think so. DHS, who do we have? We have Ms. Grom. Welcome back to the committee. Great to see you. Oh, where are you? We can't hear you, but you're unmuted. There you go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. We would anticipate this to be a pretty customary state plan amendment process. I don't foresee any difficulty in achieving approval on this. I can certainly check with our federal relations and healthcare team to make certain, but I think looking at the bill, we don't see this as an issue.
Okay. I'm not seeing any. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, this is being laid over, and there is definitely merit for it. I know it on a number of the bills, and this is just an urging to the chair as we all contemplate looking at the fiscal side of these requests. Have you heard anything new in terms of the status for a number of fiscal notes from the LBO and where we stand with one of those, any of those currently?
I'm sorry, Representative Albright, did you direct that at DHS?
At DHS or for you, if you've heard.
Oh, here we go. Mr. Berg, he's the right person. Mr. Berg, please.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. Mr. Harney and I can provide a list of completed fiscal notes and pending fiscal notes to members if they would like to see that. We have not this year because of the way things have gone, sent a lot out in advance of committee hearings because they usually have come afterwards.
I can finish that, Mr. Berg. They're in process, Representative Albright, and we will chat after this committee, and I can show you the very long spreadsheet of where everything's at.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Closing comments, Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, I just ask members and for their support, as you as well.
Thank you. So with that, members, House File 3840 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. The next bill is House File 3729. Representative Edelson, I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to describe that amendment?
Madam Chair, yes. It adds language for the distribution methodology, and this was approved with our work. We worked with the department on this, so it's just approved language that they wanted to see as well.
Thank you. So with that, members, please unmute yourself. I'm going to move the A1 amendment to House File 3729. All those in favor? Please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. And the motion will be to lay over House File 3729 as amended for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Edelson, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Our senior home facilities are at a crisis point right now. We are seeing them close across the state. We are seeing them severely understaffed as well. The care industry, specifically with seniors with with higher needs. It's a 24-hour, seven-day-a-week industry. And I know that you guys on this committee are definitely talking about that. House Bill 3729 seeks to provide permanent solutions for skilled nursing and assisted living providers so they can attract and retain workers. This bill adds more wage cost to the facility-specific cost-based portion of the rate. It applies a known cost change factor to the nursing home rates. It converts waivers, customized living rates to fully new system rates. It provides upfront funding for nursing home facility wage increases. And with that, Madam Chair, I know you are on our timeline. I'm going to cut my comments a little shorter and just move to my testifiers.
Thank you. We first have Patty Cullen from Care Providers. Welcome. State your name, affiliation, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Edelman. I'm Patty Cullen, President, CEO of Care Providers in Minnesota. We are one half of the long-term care imperative. I think you have a few handouts in your packet that give you a lot of data. So for the sake of time, I'm going to cut my comments pretty short here. I'm just going to remind folks of a few of the statistics that we have been collecting and that cause us to ask Representative Edelman to bring this bill forward. We've changed our terminology from crisis to collapse as we've collected some of this data during the pandemic. As you all know, we have about 23,000 open positions in assisted living and nursing facilities. It's about 20% of our workforce. The unfortunate part of the implications of the pandemic and wage competition is we are continuing to lose staff. We have about 1.25 more resignations than new hires. So we try to hire new people, but the folks are leaving our communities faster than we can bring them in. We have had to hold on admissions. You have heard the stories of hospitals having backups during the height of COVID, and part of the reason is because we could not admit folks into our buildings because we didn't have the staff to take care of them. So between the hold of admission and just the decreased occupancy resulting from the significance of the pandemic, that's created really tough pressures on cash flow and operational sustainability. We also know that about 78% of facilities had been limiting admissions in our nursing facilities and about 35% in our assisted living. So not only does that impact hospitals, and again, the prior bill and testimony talked about the cost implications of keeping folks in the hospital, we have those same costs. It also prevents people from moving in from our home communities. And that has been just heart-wrenching for our, especially in rural facilities, having to say no to family members who are burnt out from caregiving, just begging us to take their folks. Just a couple other quick comments before I turn it over to one of our provider members. Cash flow, because we've had these unanticipated and unrecognized expenses tied to the pandemic, you know, $100 per test costs, the PPE that we needed to wear and continue to wear, having to pay overtime and bonuses just to keep staff, those have caused a cash flow crunch that we have never seen before, which means we've spent the federal money, we've spent the reserves, and we're down to about 40% of nursing homes and assisted living said if they miss one payment from the state, they're not going to be able to make payroll or pay any bills. And so we're at that kind of critical point when it comes to cash flow. So with that framing of some of the data, and like I said, we did include a couple of handouts all prettied up for your reference. I'm going to ask one of our members, Austin, who I think is the next testifier. Yep.
Thank you so much. So we have Austin Lilly. Is that correct? Welcome to the committee. State your name. Proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify and support a House File 3729. My name is Austin Bliley. I'm the Regional Vice President of Operations with Mission Health Communities, which manages the Northridge campus located in New Hope, Minnesota. In January of 2020, I represented 480 full-time equivalent employees. I currently represent 360. Full-time equivalent employees at the Northridge campus. Yes, we have 120 full-time equivalent vacancies across our campus. These vacancies represent job positions in the nursing field, the certified nursing assistant field, the housekeeping field, the laundry field, and the dietary field. Our campus sits, on our campus, it's the largest skilled nursing facility in the state of Minnesota. We have a large post-acute rehab, a large respiratory care unit, and two large long-term care units. Our campus also provides assisted living with dementia services, adult daycare services, and child daycare services. In January of 2020, our campus was 91% occupied. Our current occupancy is 70%. In January of 2020, we were admitting almost 70 residents a month from our local hospital system, our community partners. Our current admitting volume averages about 40 residents a month. Our ability to provide a much needed service to our greater community is greatly impacted by the workforce challenges of our industry. To speak a little bit about our application volume, in January of 2020, our monthly employee application volume exceeded 575 applicants. Our current employee application volume is about 290 applications a month. Again, our ability to provide the much needed services to our greater community is greatly impacted by the workforce challenges of our industry. Our workforce continues to step up each and every day to meet the ongoing challenges of the pandemic, performing their jobs in full PPE every day for, if it's a shift or two, 8 or 16 hours a day. The funding in this bill will not only assist our industry in getting our workforce back, but will create more financial stability for our staff that will assist them in making a choice to work in our industry, not just as a job, but as a career. The current wages that we are able to offer our employees just is not reflective of the passion it takes to care for our residents. Under our current reimbursement system, we aren't able to reflect or capture all of the expenses to properly compensate our workforce. Under our current reimbursement system, 100% of our pricing is controlled by the government. We can't just raise our prices in order to increase compensation for our employees. Between the challenges of the pandemic and the more recent challenges of inflation, our current compensation packages just are not attractive enough to the workforce. So while we are so appreciative of the short-term incentive plans, they do not impact the long-term investment that our workforce is looking for. We need a long-term reimbursement model that accurately reflects our current expenses and keeps our workforce compensated so they can support their families, take care of our residents. The items in this bill will assist us as providers in telling our workforce that yes, this industry is a fulfilling career choice and give the providers a much better platform in which to serve our communities. Thank you again, Madam Chair, for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Bliley. Next we have Benjamin Thomas. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Benjamin Thomas. I am the Executive Director of Rockma Homes, a nonprofit assisted living facility that provides dementia care in four locations, Minnetonka, Golden Valley, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. A little bit about Rockma Homes. We're kind of a unique place. We were the first home-based dementia care in Minnesota. We began in 1984. We take in people from across the metro and the state. And 80 to 85% of our population has historically been on some kind of a waiver. Furthermore, we really reflect the demographics of Minnesota. 20% of our residents are African-American, Hispanic, Native American, or immigrant of some other sort. And our staff is 75% non-white, many of whom are first-generation Americans or immigrants. You might have guessed from my outfit that this isn't my only calling. I'm an Episcopal priest, and I have made a life out of advocating for the poor and vulnerable as part of my calling. We serve people at Rockma who have dementia. They are poor, they're on waiver, and they are vulnerable because they can't take care of themselves. Our staff are also vulnerable people, as immigrants, as people who work from paycheck to paycheck. They work a lot of overtime. Many of them have two jobs. We need your help. We want to keep people safe and we want to pay our staff fairly. Last year, we budgeted $14.75 an hour for unlicensed care partners. I'm currently advertising that same position at a range between $18 and $22 an hour. On the bottom end, it's at minimum a 24% increase. And without an increase in revenue, we're not going to be able to keep our staff. Our business model will break. The metrics are pretty simple in our world. We've got census, how many people we take care of, revenue, how much, or daily rate, how much they bring in every day. We can't control our census because we only have as many beds as we have. The daily rate can change, and that's what this bill addresses. And we've got labor costs. Our labor costs have gone up without any corresponding increase in revenue. And we've left administrative positions open. We've kicked capital expenses down the road. And the only way for us to balance our budget is for this to happen, for the daily rate to go up for us. I talked to my staff about what it would mean for them to get an increase in wages. And one of them said to me, you know, I work in long-term care because I want to help these people live as normal a life as they can in spite of their limitations. And I said, well, you know, what would it do for you if we could pay you more? And she said, well, I can only have one job. She said, I love this job, but it's my second job. And a lot of my coworkers work two jobs as well, just trying to make ends meet. So if we can increase their pay, we can keep these people on board. They can continue caring for vulnerable people. One of my house managers told me recently, after we sort of gave people a pay raise, just hoping to keep them based on some money, one-time money that we have, and just in a desperate move to keep people. And so we gave this particular person a pretty substantial raise. And one of our residents, who had been asking her when she would get a raise every day when she came to work, she got to go in 2 weeks ago and say, I finally got my raise. And he said, what? I did that for you? Now, he has dementia. And so he was pretty excited because he had advocated for her in his mind. And so the two of them sort of danced around together in the living room and celebrated this moment where one of our people had a win, one of our residents had a win. And that's the kind of thing that we can do, but we'll only be able to do with your support. With this bill, we can pay for our staff. They can continue to be family to our vulnerable residents. We can keep this unique community of small home-based care alive, but only if you fix the metrics by supporting HF 3729. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. The last testifier we have is Carrie Thurlow. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So I know you've heard a lot of testimony today, and I know that your time is extremely limited, so I too will limit my comments. But I want to first start by thanking Representative Edelson for bringing forward this important bill, and Chair Schultz for hearing this legislation. If there is one thing that you can take away from the testifiers that you've heard today from Austin and Benjamin, it's that we are a sector that is on the brink of collapse, and we can't wait much longer for help. There are countless resources right now going into literally millions of dollars going into securing emergency and temporary staffing to help continue to try to meet the needs of seniors that we serve today because of the severe shortage of workforce that we have. 23,000 open positions is the equivalent of about 20% of our workforce. And I would pose to you the premise that investing in permanent wages for our workforce in assisted living and care centers today is a much better investment than continuing to try to spend millions of dollars band-aiding with temporary staffing solutions. What House File 3729 does is a fairly simple premise. It provides funding for permanent wage increases for nursing homes, as well as making adjustments to the rate setting methodology so that we can keep up better with unanticipated costs and wage inflation, as well as making much needed rate adjustments to the elderly waiver program that we know has been severely underfunded as documented by DHS back in 2019. For decades, we've known that the careers in caregiving are honorable and take special skills, and they should not be treated as minimum wage jobs, and we need your help to help us do that. This year, Minnesota became home to 1 million seniors. That's about 20% of our population. And while we have talked to this committee for years, continuing to work with each and every one of you to prepare and to help meet the needs of our growing senior population, this pandemic has laid bare the deep needs of our aging services system, beginning with the chronic workforce shortages that are fueled by the extremely low near poverty wages that some are provided today. Caregivers as a baseline need to be able to support themselves and their families, and this bill will help do that. So again, thank you for the ongoing support of professional caregivers for the last 2 years of this pandemic and for the emergency measures that you all have helped support throughout this. And thank you for your consideration of these more permanent ongoing solutions. We're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. And you know, there's no question that we want people who do really super important work, caring for others who desperately need the care. We want them to have living wages and be able to support their families and have a good life doing that super important work. The one question I have, though, probably for Ms. Thurlow, my understanding is right now it's the average cost of maintaining somebody in a nursing facility for a year is around $100,000. And first of all, I'd like to see if that's correct. I think it was confirmed in another committee, but you know, $100,000 on an annual basis to maintain someone in a nursing facility. And then if we need to, if that isn't sufficient, what should the cost be? What would be a reasonable cost? I mean, I must say I'm always really, this area of what we do always boggles my mind because there is so much money going into this space and yet it never seems to be enough. And the people doing the work are still not making livable wages. I just don't get it because we're not, you know, the way we fund nursing facilities now, as members of this committee know, is through value-based reimbursement. And so can you help me with that, Ms. Thurlow? I just still don't understand it after all my years on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Liebling, thank you for that thoughtful question. I'm going to accept the premise that the annual cost for nursing home care is around $100,000. I don't have the exact study, but that sounds about right. And you're right, expenses for long-term care are expensive. And when you calculate it out on it, and what I would first say is that our value-based reimbursement system, our members submit cost reports to the Department of Human Services annually that are audited, and they would affirm that about 60%, 65% of those costs are going to wages and benefits. So that is the single largest piece of those costs. And when you break down those costs on a daily basis, and when you think about 24-hour care, dietary, laundry, housekeeping, round-the-clock service, it starts to add up in a very quick way. So I agree that there is a future conversation and one that I think that we will be excited to work together about how we continue to work together to, I know you and I have had conversations about financing reform, long-term care. We don't have the same insurance solutions. We don't have the same financing solutions to help families pay for long-term care. But it is very clear that the rates right now support wages that are not competitive with our current wage inflation system. And again, I would go back to 65% of our costs are driven by staff wages and benefits.
Chair Liebling, follow up? No. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Edelson and Ms. Thurlow, you know, this bill really speaks to a number of issues, and I don't really have so much a question, Madam Chair, as I do have kind of an op-ed in terms of where mm-hmm. I see this going. You know, this is a tall order, and as we've talked, you know, the history around rates attendant to nursing homes, as the chair of this committee and myself and a few others on this committee can speak to, it has caused some, shall we say, robust debate on the House floor in previous years. And we're not here to debate that. But what I do want to talk about is, you know, wages are just a symptom of a much larger issue that, you know, we as a state face. I mean, unemployment right now is at a 20-year low. And what, if anything, COVID has caused us to really realize is early retirements were taken in areas where we have to backfill those with people that candidly are not prepared or aren't even ready to take on the responsibility for a career because they might still be in school. That's the proportionality to the people that have left the workforce because of the causation attendant to COVID. But then when you take a look at that, and it causes a need for a new workforce, right? But that workforce isn't even there. And you're competing with other industry sectors who are also facing those same issues. And so while I don't have an answer, I think we need to be really aware that it isn't just about the wages, although they are very, very important. It is also about how do we transform care so that it isn't always about wages? Is it about, as you know, the book Living Mortal said, you know, providing retirees and folks that have the ability to decide what every day looks like to be its best day? How do we enable and empower those people to do that through actions that we at the legislature take? So while I certainly appreciate the initiative and will be supportive of this from a wage perspective, you can pay an inordinate amount of money, but if there isn't a workforce there to accept those wages, then what have we really done to satisfy and rectify the situation? So, Madam Chair, this is a broader contextual conversation that this legislature needs to, you know, press into, take upon itself. And I'll leave it at that and hope that we can have the visionary conversations not just relegated to what is right in front of our eyes, but where we go as a state 20 and 30 years from now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we're all hearing, nursing homes are really, really struggling. And I will echo Representative Albright's concerns about this. Yes, wages need to increase. I think we've made things difficult. I find it interesting that just 3 years ago, we were talking about cutting $70 million out of nursing facility rate increases. And I won't even say we. Democrat Party was having that conversation. And yet, this is really a huge concern for our citizens, but our rural areas, we have no place to bring people. And my question to, I don't even know, maybe Mr. Thomas, are you seeing a much higher need care in your facility than you were, say, 10 years ago?
Mr. Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think our level of care has basically remained pretty flat. I don't have 10 years with this company, but my understanding from long-term employees is that we look a lot like we have always looked. The difference has been that we have had a lot of churn on the front line due to wage pressures. And as a result, I think the difficulty of caring for people has gone up because we have lost a lot of our experienced workers to other more high-paying jobs. And so although the need has stayed the same, our ability to keep up with it due to wage pressures continues to be a struggle.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess when I think about it, I've had a lot of exposure to nursing homes with family and in my young life. Actually worked in the nursing home. I just, of course, that's 40 plus years ago. And I remember the care wasn't as high for some people. They could actually dress themselves or had different medical needs that they had to have. So, my concern also is that we need to look at other things we do, funding. Maybe Ms. Thurlow can confirm this, but you know, they're waiting 2 years for reimbursement costs. I think that's something we need to talk about so that facilities aren't waiting so long to be reimbursed. And certainly we have that need, but you know, we have empty beds, not because we can't put people in them. We have empty beds because we don't have nursing abilities. So, and that's true of our hospitals also. And I have one that actually is sharing staff so that they can fill whatever they need at the time, the hospital or the nursing home. So with that, I'll move on. But I just think those are some other things we need to take care of. And thank you, Representative Edelson, for that this bill. I really appreciate the conversation, and I think we need to move forward with some of this, but the cost is concerning for our people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kale. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the conversation on the topic. We certainly know that there are staffing shortages in all sorts of human service industries. One question I do have is for Ms. Thurlow. When she was answering the question of Chair Liebling, when she was talking about labor costs, I'm curious if the numbers that she's citing for that is just the direct support professionals in the direct care workers, or is that including support staff, administrative staff, everyone, or just kind of the breakdown?
Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Thank you, Representative Frederick. I may have to phone a friend here. We do have what we affectionately call our data guys that pull that number. I want to say that it's inclusive of both, but perhaps either Jeff Bostick or Todd Bergstrom could very quickly answer that question.
Yep. Yes.
Mr. Bergstrom,
Madam Chair,
please state your name.
I'm sorry. This is Todd Bergstrom, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick, members of the committee. Yes, that number, when we say 65-66%, that is all wage and salary costs of persons directly employed at the facility.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess when it comes to these investments and we're hearing about the shortages of the frontline staff, I would just hope that when we see wage increases, that the frontline staff are the ones that are also being supported the most with any of our efforts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I feel compelled to respond to Representative Keel's point because this keeps coming up and I think we need a little context around it. And so some years ago, as members of this committee probably know, the Republican Party put funding for nursing homes, I shouldn't say the Republican Party, sorry, members of the Republican Party in the legislature, put nursing home funding kind of on automatic pilot, this value-based reimbursement where they get reimbursed for actual costs, unlike any other sector in our human services ecosystem here. They get constantly increasing payments. And so this was, of course, brought to us by Ms. Thurlow and others in the industry. And the Republican Party, Republicans in the legislature were just really happy to put this in. And there was a need at the time, absolutely, there was a need to increase funding. But the scheme that was put in place wasn't perfect, as much law isn't perfect when it first goes into place. There was a quality component which was set too low. And that quality component needed adjustment. Basically, everybody was getting the extra quality bump, everybody, whether there was quality or not. And so when Republicans keep talking about how Democrats wanted to decrease the funding, what we wanted to do was adjust the quality component so there would be quality, an incentive for actual quality. So I wanted to make that clear. The other thing I want to say is, and this is not to say there aren't still needs. I'm not saying that we don't still need to raise people's wages. That we absolutely do need to see. And I'm not saying there isn't a workforce shortage, because there absolutely is one. But what we also saw after this new system of funding nursing homes went into place is that we have in this industry a really mixed bag of who these different facilities are. And I believe that I'm correct in saying that we saw an increase in those that are for profit. in the industry. So there must have been something really good going on with that extra funding from Republicans, because a lot of for-profit entities have entered the space. Now, whether that's good or not, I'm not saying, but you know, this is the dynamic that's happening. So I just want to stop hearing from Republicans about how we tried to cut the nursing homes. We tried to adjust and fix what they set in motion that was not, you know, when you try to fix something and adjust it, sometimes it results in less money in that year going out the door. But I think that quality is really important in the nursing home industry. And that was supposed to be part of the original legislation and just didn't work out exactly right. So I just wanted to give that context so that we don't just keep hearing this over and over. And I wouldn't have made this partisan, except that I've now heard this twice, once in a previous hearing and now from Representative Keel today. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And members, we have to move on. I apologize. We need to get this bill and move on to the next. So with that, members, House File 37.
Madam Chair,
Representative Elton. Sorry.
I apologize. I appreciate the robust discussion, but if we look at in 2030 with our projected baby boomers being 21% of our population, this isn't going away. And I appreciate that wages alone won't solve it. We also need immigration or migration. And so what are we going to do about it? I guess I would just hope that we can have that discussion as well, because I can tell you, as my father-in-law was at a care facility, more than half of the employees were first-generation immigrants. We could not do it without them. So I hope that when we're talking about these discussions that we will also talk about that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to lay over House File 3729 as amended for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Okay, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Bonner now. Vice Chair Bonner, the gavel is now yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, next on the agenda, we have House File 4527. This is a reviser bill to clean up some obsolete language. And I will make the motion to lay over House File 4527 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. I do not see any amendments. Chair Schultz, would you like to proceed and tell us about your bill?
Thank you, members. This is just a technical bill, House File 4527, and we have House Research here, the incredible Danielle Punelli, who's been working day and night for us, as she does every year. Ms. Punelli, could you please describe the bill for members very quickly?
Yes, Madam Chair. This bill is just a really technical bill that moves some sections around within Chapter 256D, just to reorganize that and make it better organized and clearer.
And Ms. Pinelli, can you explain the repealer?
The repealer is repealing some language that's obsolete that DHS doesn't need anymore.
I know. So when the public and members see that, it's just obsolete. We're not making any changes. Representative Albright. Oh, sorry, Chair Bonner.
That's all right. Chair Schultz, Representative Albright, you have a question.
Madam Chair, yes, to the author of the bill, a couple questions. First, I won't devolve into a deep dive of State Statute 256D, but just wondering what color is the vehicle and what kind of tires are on this car?
You really want me to answer that question?
Representative Schultz.
It's a great vehicle. It's a great vehicle. It's going now right to the floor. That's how great it is, Representative Albright, right? Isn't it going to the floor?
Madam Chair, you'd probably want to lay this one over if this is your vehicle bill.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Actually, Chair Schultz, we are laying this bill over.
Okay. You see, I haven't had my coffee yet. It's just sitting here because I didn't want to take a drink yet. Okay, so members, this is just a recod bill and a vehicle bill. So I have nothing else to say unless you have another question, Representative Albright.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I hope it's a pickup because it's going to have to carry a lot of weight in the backside of the truck.
And, you know, do you see how small this bill is? It's one page. Let's see what happens to it when it's finalized. Okay. End of discussion. We need to move on, Vice Chair Bonner.
All right, Chair Schultz, if there are no other questions, then I will go ahead and move that this bill be laid over, or House File 4527 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance and Policy Bill. And last on the agenda today, we have House File 4447. The motion is to lay House File 4447 over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Bill. Chair Schultz, I do not see any amendments, so if you'd like to go ahead and proceed with telling us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bonner and members. This is an incredible bill. I just want to thank everyone who's worked on this from the agency and others. And unfortunately, we only have, I think, 15 minutes to get through this entire bill, but it's incredible. What it does, it's our workforce bill, and it has it's a great package. It provides reimbursement for frontline workers because, as everyone knows, they provide life-sustaining support for our vulnerable populations, those with behavioral health conditions, those with disabilities, older adults, people experiencing housing instability and homelessness. And we have record high vacancies, as we've heard, in the direct care industry. We have huge historic demographic shifts in our labor market. Our priority this session is to address the healthcare workforce crisis, and people are desperately need healthcare access. So this bill does so many wonderful things. I hope you can all support it. The strategies fall into four main categories. First, we have a medical assistance, MA rate increase. We have incentives for frontline workers. We have new programs that support low-wage workers and career pathways, and then we have other administrative strategies, and I want to get right to our testifiers today to explain all the details.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. And with that, our first testifier up today is Ms. Bailey. Do we have Ms. Bailey? All right, Ms. Bailey. And I do want to remind testifiers, we are coming up close to our time, so please keep your comments to about 2 minutes and be concise. And with that, Ms. Bailey, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Well, thank you, Chair Bonner, and thank you, Representative Schultz. For the record, Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. And I just want to mention very quickly how appreciative we are of Chair Schultz for her leadership in this area, as well as this whole committee, and how much focus you've spent on the workforce shortage concerns in our health and human services sector. As been mentioned, the breadth, magnitude, and likely duration of this workforce shortage really requires us as a state, agencies, legislators, providers, counties, to really deploy multiple strategies, both in the short term and long term, to ensure that people relying on these critical services have access to them. And I would say this bill does that. It has multiple strategies that can really get at different ways of targeting the workforce shortage. Just to highlight really quickly some things that the administration is very appreciative of this bill, in that it includes several really important rate increases in the Medicaid space to ensure that people have access to services. And these include significant rate increases in the PCA and Community First Services and Supports framework, as well as the elderly waiver framework and other services. I would like to mention that these are really critical because they provide permanent ongoing investments that enable workers to have higher wages and providers then to attract and maintain those workers. And I would also like to mention that, we're really appreciative of the fact that these investments really go towards services that are provided in people's own homes to ensure that they are able to stay in their own homes and maintain access to services in that space. Also appreciative that this bill includes workforce incentives and key investments in the behavioral health space so that those service providers can retain and maintain their workers. Also includes administrative strategies that you'll also see in the governor's budget that we as a department can deploy to help people attract and maintain their staffing. And this includes expanding our Direct Support Connect web content, enabling us to update and develop content, resources, materials for people looking for staff, as well as staff looking for people needing support. And also expanding our culture of safety initiative. Culture of safety is an approach that seeks to really move a critical incident system away from a culture of blame to a culture of accountability. And what's in this bill would enable us to have resources to expand this pilot statewide. And research has shown that the culture of safety model really greatly impacts our workforce retention by creating kind of cultural systems changes within provider organizations. And lastly, I would say this bill includes really creative solutions to increase people working in the health and human services sector by providing supports to people receiving SNAP and MFIP to complete their degrees in healthcare occupations. So a really creative solution to kind of merge multiple programs that we run here at the department to get at this workforce shortage. So appreciative of Chair Schultz to have those creative solutions in this bill. Again, thank you for enabling us to testify and share our thoughts on this bill. And I, as well as the DHS team, is here to answer any questions on behalf of the department. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. And next up, we have Ms. Holden. Ms. Holden?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Hello, my name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. MNCCD is a broad-based coalition of individuals, advocacy organizations, and providers working to change public policy to improve the lives of people with disabilities in Minnesota. Both Legal Aid and MNCCD have just been alarmed at the impact of the workforce shortage and the impact on the lives of people with disabilities and elders across the state. You've heard stories this session from people who have worked for decades to build a life in their own place, only to have to give it up this winter and move to a congregate setting, of people who've been happy in their group home for decades, only for it to close for lack of staff and leave their family scrambling to find something else, usually moving to a less community-based option. Many of us in the disability community feel like we're watching the progress and promise of inclusion and integration for people with disabilities fall away before our eyes. Not just in the short term, but that there will be lasting impacts on the options for people who have disabilities to live in the homes and communities they choose and for elders to age in place. We've been calling for short and for long-term solutions, and this bill hits on both. We need to retain the workers that we have now, and the workforce incentive grants in Section 3 would help with that. And we need to structurally invest in rates as a needed long-term solution, because otherwise these industries that are funded by Medicaid will be structurally left behind other job opportunities in the community. We are thrilled to see in Section 7 the increase in the PCA implementation factor. We really see the PCA program as an essential part of the future of care services, flexibly in people's homes and the communities that they choose, near their neighbors and families. And as you know, it serves and employs and proportionately more Minnesotans of color than other HCBS programs. But the rates have been so far behind, it continues to struggle to keep up with wages in other industries. I want to highlight how this bill changes the PCA rate and why it would be so helpful. As you know, the framework is based on using component values based on market rates for similar work. And then there's this implementation factor that essentially discounts it. Right now, it cuts it down to about 75% of what we did calculate would be the cost of providing that service. So essentially, the state is getting a discount, and we're paying only 75% of what it costs to actually provide that service. So it's no wonder why so many folks are struggling to find PCAs. This bill increases that implementation factor by 8%, which is a really smart way to invest in this program because the change will be structural and ongoing. I also want to speak specifically on behalf of Legal Aid in support of the improvements to services for elders. Elders in our community often want to stay in their homes and communities, and elderly waiver services make that possible, but that's really only possible if there are workers available to provide the support. So just like disability waivers, older adults on elderly waivers and alternative care can use consumer-directed options to allow for friends, families, and other informal caregivers to provide that reimbursed care. But the CDC's option for EW is woefully underfunded, and this bill would bring parity to this option and allow more older adults to stay to age in place. We also really appreciate the investments to alternative care and essential community supports. I hear from our attorneys all the time about how important alternative care is. Thank you so much for investing in it. I know we're short on time. I would just want to say thank you, Chair Schultz, and everyone on this committee. You have spent so much time in this session tackling the workforce shortage and its long-term impacts, and we are so grateful and look forward to continue to work with you on it.
Thank you. And next up, we have Ms. Bender. And I do want to remind folks that we have only about 6 minutes left, so please be concise in your remarks.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, Vice Chair Bonner, and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to present testimony on House File 4447 in support of the provisions that increase the PCA rate formula and provide workforce incentive grants. My name is Jean Bender. I'm a board member and advocacy committee co-chair of the Autism Society of Minnesota. We hear frequently from our members about the impact of the direct support workforce shortage, but I'm not going to share those stories today because I have my own experiences as the parent of a 35-year-old with multiple disabilities. My son David has very high support needs requiring 24-hour per day assistance with all activities of daily living. He's unable to walk and cannot even reposition himself without help. About 15 years ago, we bought a duplex. David lives downstairs and his dad and I live upstairs. Our hope was to support David's transition from living with his parents to living in his own home with supports. Because of the inability to find and retain direct support staff, we still provide the majority of David's care. We currently have one person, Maya, who works daytime hours Tuesday through Friday, and one person, Tanya, who works one evening every 2 weeks as her third job. Last year, my husband was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer. As he recovered from surgery and was sick from chemotherapy, I had many days running up and down the stairs from one home to the other, caring for both of them. And for those of you problem solvers wondering why we didn't just move downstairs temporarily, I'm getting to that. This isn't just about me and my concern about how long I can continue this level of support. This is primarily about David and his quality of life. David has very little spoken language, one or two words at a time. About a year after moving into the duplex, I went into his home when he had staff and he was in the middle of an art project. He knew it wasn't time for his staff to leave, so he looked at me and said, "Upstairs." We had never modeled that word for him before. People had wondered why we'd set up the duplex model because they didn't think David would understand that one home was his and the other ours. Upstairs said it all. Our duplex model and community-based versions of housing and supports costs significantly less than traditional programs and provides more individualized supports tailored to a person's needs and choices. But neither our model nor traditional programs can work without investment into the workforce. The provisions in this bill that increase the PCA rate formula and provide workforce incentive grants will help with hiring and retention of direct support workers. So David can send mom and dad upstairs more frequently and Tanya won't have to work three jobs.
All right. We have 3 minutes left, and we do have one additional testifier, Ms. Anderson. I'm not sure if you can do an abbreviated version.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will do an abbreviated version. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire Minnesota. And today, to be simply grateful and in concert with the other testifiers for this important proposal. Our mental health crisis is grave, as you know, and so we are especially grateful for three particular provisions, the mental health supervision grants that are also before you with Representative Bang's House File 3418, the workforce incentive funds that are also before you with Chair Fisher's 3215, and the behavioral health training support, which we like to call the behavioral health peers. We like to call the secret sauce for effectiveness is really important intensive services for kids and families in our space. So with great gratitude, we look forward to collaborating to pull all of the ideas together to come up with the very best proposal to pass at the very end of the session. So simply with gratitude, we resign the rest of our time. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you for that, Ms. Anderson. Representative Albright, we do have 1 minute left, and we have to lay this bill over before we get cut off by House media. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's not so much a question as just a point of note for the author of the bill. Representative Schultz, and the way that I read the language, and I'm just not sure that I'm reading it right, but I think I am. The workforce incentive fund grants in your bill are only allowed to go to nonprofit groups, which to me doesn't make sense, considering that ARMS members statewide are roughly 50-50 nonprofit and for-profit. So about 90% of the for-profits have 10 or fewer service locations as well. So the for-profits can't change more. They can't charge more, sorry. So every provider would be getting the same rate, completely dependent upon the resident's needs, and that determined by the DWRS.
Yes, Representative Albright, the great thing about this bill is it's being laid over so we can work on it.
We'll have more conversation.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you, members, for hearing the bill. That's all I have.
All right. And with that, members, I'm going to lay over House File 4447 for possible inclusion. And with that, our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 29th at 10:30. Thank you, and we are adjourned.